In just a moment, you'll hear an address by the Honorable Adlai E. Stevenson. But first, a word about the 1954 Red Cross Drive. Calls for help come to the Red Cross every minute of every day. By joining your Red Cross, you make sure these urgent appeals will be answered. Through Red Cross, each American as an individual can do his part for humanity.
Stevenson, speaking at the dinner closing the two-day Southern Conference of the Democratic National Committee.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to present to you now a loyal Democrat and a distinguished United States Senator for whose work in behalf of our country and our party we are all grateful, the Honorable John Sparkman of Alabama, who will introduce our speaker.
Mr. Toastmaster, distinguished Democrats attending this great Southern Democratic meeting and friends everywhere, I'm greatly honored to have the privilege of presenting to you the principal speaker of the evening. I shall always be proud of the fact that I was permitted by our great party to work closely with him in a campaign which, even though we did not get a majority of the votes, saw 27 million American voters lined up on our side. During and since that campaign, he made a deep and lasting impression on the American people. He is a clear thinker, a forceful speaker, a fearless advocate, a statesman in every sense of the word, a great standard bearer. I'm honored to present to this magnificent audience, Adlai Stevenson.
Toastmaster, Governor John, Senator Sparkman, honored guests, and ladies and gentlemen. Your introduction, Senator Sparkman, and your welcome here in Miami has touched me deeply, which I suppose is something that we all have in common at this very expensive dinner. This has been a fateful week in the history of American government. We are witnessing the bitter harvest from the seeds of slander, defamation, and disunion planted in the soil of our democracy. I don't propose to respond in kind tonight to the calculated campaign of deceit to which we have been exposed of late, nor to the insensate attacks on Democrats as traitors, communists, and murderers of our sons. Those of us, and they are most of us, who are more Americans than Democrats or Republicans, count some things more important than the winning or the losing of elections. There is a peace still to be won, an economy which needs some attention, some freedoms to be secured, an atom to be controlled, all through the delicate, sensitive, indispensable mechanisms of democracy. Mechanisms which demand, at the very least, that people's vision be clear, that they be told the truth, and that they respect one another. A year ago, at this time, there was every reason to hope that we were on the threshold of an era of great good feeling among Americans. Yet today, where we hope for harmony, we have discord. Where we yearn for healing, we have hostility. Where we look forward to a nation united, we have a people divided. Where we expected candor, we have misrepresentation. Where we expected firm leadership, we have timidity. It is wicked. It is subversive for public officials to try deliberately to replace reason with passion, to substitute hatred for honest difference, to fulfill campaign promises by practicing deception, and to hide discord among Republicans by sowing the dragon's teeth of discord among Americans. The loyalty, the patriotism of a whole political party, of one half of the nation, has been indicted. 20 years of bipartisan effort, highly intelligent and highly successful, has been called 20 years of treason under the auspices, if you please, of the Republican National Committee. When one party says that the other is the party of traitors who have deliberately conspired to betray America, to fill our government services with communists and with spies, to send our young men to unnecessary death in Korea, they violate not only the limits of partisanship, not only they also offend the credulity of our people, and they also stain the vision of America and of democracy for us and for the world that we seek to lead. That such things are said under the official sponsorship of the Republican Party in celebration of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln adds desecration to defamation. This is the first time that politicians, Republicans at that, have sought to split the Union in Lincoln's honor. This system of ours is wholly dependent upon a mutual confidence in the loyalty, the patriotism, the integrity of purpose of both parties. Extremism produces extremism. Lies beget lies. The infection of bitterness and of hatred spreads all too quickly from one area of another to another of our life. And those who live by the sword of slander may also perish by it. For now, it is also being used against distinguished Republicans. We have just seen the sorry spectacle of this in the baseless charges hurled against our honored Chief Justice. And now, too, the highest officials of the Pentagon are charged with coddling communists and shielding treason. General Zwicker, one of our great army's finest officers, is denounced by Senator McCarthy as stupid, arrogant, witless, as unfit to be an officer, and a disgrace to the uniform. For what? For obeying orders. This to a man who has been decorated 13 times for gallantry and for brilliance, a hero of the Battle of the Bulge, and this from a man whom the Republican National Committee sends around the country to sow slander and disunion in memory of Abraham Lincoln. When demagoguery and deceit become a national political movement, we Americans are in trouble, not just Democrats, but all of us. Our State Department has been abused and demoralized. The American voice abroad has been enfeebled. Our educational system has been attacked. Our press threatened. Our servants of God impugned. A former president maligned. The executive departments invaded. Our foreign policy confused. The president himself patronized. And now the integrity, the loyalty, the morale of the United States Army has been assailed. For a moment, it looked as if this most recent audacity would at last meet effective resistance. But instead, well, what I might say, as a Democratic partisan, would have little value. But the pattern of this long series of aggressions against the Republic is clear, and the consequences terrible. The logic of all this is not only the intimidation and silence of all independent institutions and opinion in our society, but the capture of one of our great instruments of political action, the Republican Party. And the end result, in short, is a malign and a fatal totalitarianism. And why, you ask, have the demagogues triumphed so often? The answer is inescapable. Because a group of political plungers has persuaded the president that McCarthyism is the best Republican formula for political success. Had the Eisenhower administration chosen to act in defense of itself and of the nation, which it must govern, it would have had the grateful and the dedicated support of all but a tiny and deluded minority of our people. Yet clear as the issue is, and unmistakable as the support, the administration appears to be helpless. Why? Because the party which created the administration is hopelessly, dismally, fatally torn and rent within itself. Seems to me that this Stevens incident illustrates what preceding events have made memorably plain. A political party divided against itself, half McCarthy and half Eisenhower, cannot produce national unity, cannot govern with confidence and with purpose. And it demonstrates that so long as it attempts to share power with its enemies, it will inexorably lose power to them. Perhaps you will say that I am making not a Democratic but a Republican speech, that I am counseling unity and courage in the Republican Party and administration. And you bet I am. For as Democrats, we don't believe in political extermination of Republicans, nor do we believe in political fratricide, in the extermination of one another. We believe in the Republic we exist to serve, and we believe in the two-party system that serves it, and that can only serve it, at home and abroad, by the best and the noblest of democracy's processes. And there is nothing, by the way, except abuse of democracy's processes in this deception about the 1,456 or the 2,200 or the 2,427. Employees allegedly removed from government jobs as security risks. We were told last October by the White House that 1,456 government employees had been removed as security risks. The president later raised the figure to 2,200. And we were told by the governor of New York, the postmaster general, the counsel to the president, and countless other Republican leaders that most of these were subversives, spies, and traitors who had been kicked out of government. Some of these orators even suggested that they had been planted in the government. You remember all of the campaign talk about communism and corruption and what the Republicans were going to do if they won to clean up the mess in Washington, as they called it. And I don't mean to taunt them with that phrase. Well, as you may have heard, they won the election. And when they didn't find the government crawling with spies and traitors, they started this numbers game to show how well they were doing. Now, after 4 months, and I hope not too late for the truth to catch up with the falsehood, the administration is doing a little confused explaining. The figure has now been raised to 2,427, I'm told. But the only thing we know for sure is the government's reluctant admission that out of more than 2 million federal employees, only one alleged active communist has been found. It looks to me as though the Great Crusade had practiced a great deception. They may consider this good politics, but it is vicious government. We will await the final results with interest, and also the administration's apologies to the many innocent, loyal people who have been injured by this unscrupulous, un-American numbers racket. Everyone hopes that the administration will find and remove all the real subversives and keep them out of our government. For a single disloyal or dangerous employee is one too many. And I do not hold that the past should be closed. On the contrary, experience will remain a powerful and ever-present reminder of the price of anything less than eternal vigilance. But I do hold that past errors do not excuse new ones, that democracy's ideals and vitality must not be despoiled by those who purport to defend those ideals. The president says he disapproves of all of these goings-on, this slander and deceit, this bitterness and ugliness, these attempts to subordinate a nation's common purposes to a divided party's political ambitions. He has said so repeatedly in statements to the press. But the nation's ideals continue to be soiled by the mud of political expediency. This internal crisis makes it all the more urgent that the Democratic Party remain strong, responsible, and attentive to the nation's business. I note that no Democrat has charged that the whole Republican Party is corrupt merely because 3 Republican congressmen in a row have been convicted of defrauding the government. We know that Republicans and Democrats alike want better government. Government that measures up to the ideals of a proud people, to the dignity which befits the leader among nations, to the standard we think of as the reward citizens receive from a democracy for which they pay and work, for which they pray and fight, and see their sons die to preserve. Now more than ever, America must be a citadel of sanity and of reason. We live in a troubled, dangerous, anxious world where the great issues are peace or war, and the stakes, life or death. Perhaps these melancholy diversions explain, for example, why there has been so little public curiosity about such a genuine concern as the new look in national defense and foreign policy. I had hoped that there might be a resumption in this administration of the bipartisanship of President Truman's administration, when Secretary Dulles and many other prominent Republicans, including the president himself, served in important roles. At all events, without the benefit of bipartisanship, the administration has recently unveiled this new look. It has been presented to us as a program of more for our money, national security in the large economy size, a bigger bang for a buck. Well, I don't presume to understand its full implications. They are sobering enough to require searching, responsible national discussion. The background of any evaluation of this new program must be stern realization that the peril of the free world is not diminishing. It is in that spirit, and in no spirit of partisan relish, that I offer comment tonight. We are told, and I am quoting the words of Secretary Dulles, that we have rejected the traditional policy of meeting aggression by direct and local opposition. We have taken the decision, he says, to depend primarily upon a great capacity to retaliate instantly by means and at places of our choosing. But some setbacks to the cause of freedom, some communist successes, Mr. Dulles says, should be regarded as normal. All this means, if it means anything, is that if the communists try another Korea, we will retaliate by dropping atom bombs on Moscow or Beijing or wherever we choose. Or else we will concede the loss of another Korea and presumably other countries after that as normal in the course of events. Is this a new look, or is it a return to the pre-atomic, the pre-1950 atomic deterrent strategy, which made some sense so long as we had a monopoly of atomic weapons, together with a strategic air force? Yet even then, I remind you that it did not deter attack and brought us to the brink of disaster in Korea, where atom bombs were useless. And we were only saved by heroic exertion to recreate conventional ground forces. But you say we did not use the bomb against Russian or Chinese targets for fear of enlarging the war. Exactly. And if we should now use them in retaliation that way, it would certainly mean World War III and atomic counter-retaliation. For the Russians have massive power of retaliation with atomic weapons just as we do. And our cities also are susceptible to destruction. And if air atomic power is our policy, what are we doing to build up the Air Force, let alone continental defenses? Last year, they cut the Air Force by $5 billion below President Truman's request and said it would actually strengthen the armed forces, which reminds me of Senator Russell's engaging remark. He said, well, if that's the case, why don't they cut it $10 billion and double our strength? This year, they have partially restored the Air Force cut, but reduced the amount for aircraft procurement and cut the Army over $4 billion. It seems to me ironic that the same men who a few months ago were impulsively slashing the Air Force buildup are now, with equal impulsiveness, acting as if air atomic power were a completely satisfactory substitute for reduced military and naval power. Another question. What if we are confronted with something less than a clear case of overt aggression? What if we had relied exclusively on a policy of massive retaliation since the close of World War II? Would we have resorted to global atomic war in order to meet the communist threat in Greece and Turkey, to counter the Berlin blockade, to resist aggression in Korea? If the answer to that is no, then the so-called new look in foreign policy is no new look at all, but merely a continuation of the policy of adapting our methods of resistance to the method of attack, a policy which has brought the free world through many crises without precipitating a Martian catastrophe. Instead of greater freedom of choice, does this decision to rely primarily on atomic weapons really narrow our choice as to the means and places of retaliation? Are we leaving ourselves the grim choice of inaction or thermonuclear Holocaust? Are we indeed inviting Moscow and Beijing to nibble us to death? This is the real danger, and this is the real problem. Will we turn brush fires and local hostilities into major conflicts? Will our allies go along? Using weapons short of war and relying upon our reluctance to embark on global war, the communist imperialism will attempt to absorb country after country, to close the ring around us, and to decide the issue between tyranny and freedom long before a final outburst of atomic fury. It seems to me that the new weapons, even if we had a complete monopoly, are no answer to all of the complicated aspects of this worldwide struggle, for armed aggression is only one of the many shapes of the communist menace. And the only thing new about the new look appears to be the weakening of our Navy and ground forces and reducing the non-atomic programs and policies that we need to win the Cold War. was the administration caught between two conflicting sets of promises to reduce the budget and also strengthen our defenses? Did it choose the former because the one thing that could not be cut, the sine qua non of our security, is the new weapons and air power? I don't know. But if true bipartisanship in the formulation of policy in matters of such grave import is impossible, at least we are entitled to the facts and to the truth unadorned. If our military policy is beyond the further financial endurance of this country, if this reliance on retaliation is the only reasonable policy for the long haul, then frankly tell us so and why. But don't confuse us and frighten our allies by misbranding disengagement as advance and retrenchment as initiative. Don't tell us that we have something new and better for less when we haven't. It may be that they don't mean what they say, or that I have misinterpreted what they say. But issues of life and death should be clarified and not clouded, for security in our age cannot be bought by slogans and gimmicks. It is only, my friends, in the strength of freedom, in the fortitude and the sacrifice of free peoples, it is only in the humility of all men under God that we can create a future not scratched from the wreck and the rubble of war or from the chaos of domestic disorder, but rising from the love and the faith and the devotion of unconquerable humanity. I hope that we can soon begin to talk with one another about our affairs more seriously, more moderately, and honestly. Whether it be our foreign policy or the patriotism of our people and our public servants, there has been enough, too much of slander, of dissension, and of deception. We cannot afford such wastage of our resources of mind and spirit. For there is important work to do, which will be done together, or it won't be done at all. It is for us, all of us, to recapture the great unifying spirit which still surges so strongly through the hearts and the minds of America. Let us, I say then, as Democrats, resist the ugly provocations of this hour, and try to cut the pattern of America's future, not from the scraps of dissension and bitterness, but rather from the full, rich fabric of America's ideals and aspirations. Let us, in Thomas Jefferson's words, restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are dreary things, and without which, I could add, tomorrow's misfortunes will mock today's expectation. Thank
you have heard an address by the Honorable Adlai E. Stevenson speaking from the Miami Beach Municipal Auditorium on the occasion of the dinner closing the two-day Southern Conference of the Democratic National Committee.
This is the NBC Radio Network.